Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Murder Mile, a true crime podcast, an audio-guided walk featuring many of London's untold, unsolved, and long-forgotten murders, all set within London's West End. Today's episode is about Sedu Dirasuba, a promising young man from a good solid family, and having had a great start in life, he was popular, educated, and bright. But believing that he had to carry a knife, instead of becoming someone great, he became just another statistic. Murder Mile is researched using the original sources. It contains moments of satire, shock, and grisly details. And as a dramatization of the real events, it may also feature loud and realistic sounds, so that, no matter where you listen to this podcast, you'll feel like you're actually there. My name is Michael, I am your tour guide, and this is Murder Mile. Episode 66, Sedu Dirasuba, Another Wasted Life. Today, I'm standing on Oxford Street, W1. Two streets southeast of the flat where Marion Lee Smith was stabbed to death by her brain-damaged son. Two blocks east of the Mount Royal Hotel, where Helen Mary Pickford died after a horrifically botched abortion. And two streets north of the curious death of the flamboyant millionaire, Roberto Troyan. Coming soon to Murder Mile. As the busiest shopping district in Britain, Oxford Street draws more than 200 million visitors every year. Lured by its bright lights, scammed by its oversized signs, and duped by the totally false discounts, only to waste a day trawling the same high street stores they could ignore anywhere else, whilst jostled by deodorant dodgers, pavement ditherers, golf sale guys, and Satan's screaming spawn. Although horrifically busy on Saturdays, Oxford Street is worse during National Dickhead Week, a fictional event known by retailers as the January Sales. Beginning in December, and soon in June, the sales see swarms of red-faced morons scrabbling to buy last season's shit, saved from the skip, solely so they can brag to their bored buddies about how they saved 75% off a price it never was, for an item they never wanted, only to take it back the next day and be denied a refund as they lost the receipt. Currently empty, after the collapse of HMV's flagship music store, 363 Oxford Street was a sports shop called Foot Locker, which stocked some high-end running shoes for wannabe athletes, but mostly tacky flashy trainers for fat-wheezing frogs with no taste. And although, on the 26th of December 2011, eager shoppers were lured here by the promise of prices slashed, what they witnessed was a bloodbath. As it was here, during the Boxing Day sales of 2011, being torn between a decision to kill or be killed, that 18-year-old Sedu Dirasuba would needlessly die, and all for nothing. originating from the Ivory Coast in West Africa. As decent, honest and hard-working Muslims, although Mr. and Mrs. Dirisuba hailed from one of Africa's most prosperous nations, with a wealth gap so wide that 46% of the people lived in poverty, and the former French colony torn apart by armed rebellions and political coups, they made a bold decision and fled the Ivory Coast for a better life abroad. Having travelled 4,500 miles from Abidjan to Britain, swapping French for English, sand for smog, and sunshine for rain, London in the late 1980s must have been a real culture clash. But it was in Merton, South London, where they would settle, seeking the things that any good parent would want for their babies: safety, education, and prosperity. And raising their two boys and a girl to be polite, loyal, and respectful. In 1993, their youngest son was born, and they named him Seydou. Described by his parents as loving, down-to-earth, respectful and charismatic, and being blessed with a beaming smile a mile wide, an infectious laugh, and a cheeky cherubic face which made this young man look years younger, Seydou seemed like a good lad who could truly do nothing wrong. As a joker with a big personality, Seydou was well respected amongst his peers and was seen as a loyal friend who would do anything to protect those he loved. As a devout Muslim, he lived by the belief that everything happened by the will of Allah, and regarded by his school friends as the nicest person you could ever hope to meet. Although he was educated at Rutledge High School in Merton, a state comprehensive in a poor part of town, Seydou was one of the bright kids. Praised by his teacher as a charming, personable young man with a lot of potential, who later went on to study business at South Thames College, her only concern was his poor attendance. Seydou was a poor black youth living on the outskirts of inner city London. And yet, he had everything: a loving family, loyal friends, a good education, and an unshakable faith. He was charming, talented, and ambitious. Against the odds, he was given a great start in life. So where did it all go wrong? Raised on the notorious Phipps Bridge estate, which began as 5 high-rise tower blocks to provide affordable homes for working-class families in the 1960s, soon descended into chaos, as being badly maintained and forgotten about by the cash-strapped council. A broken light led to a smashed window, and soon enough, Phipps Bridge became the epitome of crime-ridden squalor. Described as an experience in misery, with walls thick with graffiti, streets blocked by burnt-out cars, and playgrounds awash with heroin needles, under strict security, the estate was often used as a grimy backdrop for police dramas. In 1993, the year that Seydou was born, Phipps Bridge was being renovated. And with 4 of the high-rise tower blocks demolished and a massive injection of cash, living standards were better, but the criminal element remained, bringing drugs to the streets. By 2010, 1 year before Seydou's death, Phipps Bridge was in decline, being described as one of South London's most notorious crime vortexes. And although council estates are often demonised by the press and television as breeding grounds for crack addicts, dole dossers and criminal lowlifes, if this was true, why do the vast majority of the tenants remain good, honest and hard-working people, just like Mr. and Mrs. Dirisuba? Seydou was raised as a moral and decent young man. He had everything to live for, and yet he died for nothing. In his adolescence, Seydou still had the same beaming smile, but growing bigger and broader as the young boy became a man. To make his baby face seem more adult, he grew a little bum-fluff moustache. Like most teenagers, with hormones racing, emotions raging, and everything confusing. Trapped between being a child and an adult, life was frustrating. And lacking any money, privacy, or freedom, he often tested the boundaries of what was right and wrong. But then again, who doesn't? By the age of 17, when most teenagers are working their first jobs, studying for exams, or focusing their energies on sports, arts, or music, Seydou had stopped attending South Thames College. At home, he remained his mother's little angel. But on the streets, he had fashioned himself a new identity. And looking like any young man, in neat Levi jeans, Nike trainers, and stylish blue hooded tops, his clothes hid a battle-scarred body, sliced apart by his enemy's blades. Whether Seydou was in a gang, we may never know. Some sources state that he was a senior gang member. Some say that he was little more than an underling on the periphery, and yet his family deny that he was ever in a gang at all. Age 14, it is said that Seydou broke a boy's jaw in a fight. At a house party in Croydon, he and his friends beat two boys from a rival gang, Black and Blue. And on the 29th of September 2010, he allegedly stole a BlackBerry smartphone in a robbery in Clapham. The victim was badly beaten, and Seydou initially appeared at Inner London Crown Court on the 19th of December 2011. 1 week before his death. An unnamed associate said,
"Seydou was a completely different person when he was with his friends, but that's gang life. Around other members, he was a bubbly character. But when he came across his enemies, that was a different story. You couldn't trust him. He had a cold, ruthless side and could turn on you in an instant if you were not one of his own."
Going by the street names of Tuna Raw and Nuts, owing to his alleged reputation for violence, an unnamed source stated that local teenagers would avoid him, knowing that he was armed, dangerous, and that supposedly he was the leader of the ABM gang, which stands for All About Money. According to Scotland Yard's Operation Trident, an initiative set up by the police to get guns and gangs off the streets, there are an estimated 250 active gangs in London, several in the borough of Lambeth, including the Angel Town Gas Gang in Brixton, TN1, which is code for Tell No One, the notorious Otray 1 on the borders of Lambeth and Wandsworth, the 67s on the Tulse Hill Estates, and the ABM Gang on the Stockwell Park Estate, to name but a few. And although most gangs are relatively small, covering areas as large as a whole postcode or as small as a single street, and earning very little from minor crimes like mugging, theft, and low-level drug dealing, being violent, ruthless, and territorial, 1 in 7 of all London's murders take place in the borough of Lambeth. For gang members, this is their family, and this is their life. They kill for pride. They protect their crew, they defend their territory, they attack without fear, and they don't care who gets in their way. For decades, feuds have erupted between rival factions, sometimes over incidents as volatile as a revenge attack on a fallen friend, but sometimes it is over something as simple as a look, a tut, or a word. As a former Otray 1 gang member said,
"These boys don't give a fuck about nothing. If there's a beef, then it will usually be settled with a piece or a blade."
Prior to the death of Seydou Dirasuba, there were several gang-related attacks. Valentine's Day, 2007. 15-year-old Billy Cox was shot dead in his Clapham home. Although it was linked to Otray 1, the murder remains unsolved. 6 months later, in nearby Stockwell, 16-year-old Abakar Mohammed was chased by seven youths on bikes and killed by a single gunshot to the neck. April 2009, 16-year-old Olowoseyi Ogunemi was stabbed to death by masked mob. ABM gang member Christian Johnson was found guilty of murder after police traced DNA from a trail of blood to his dog. And in 2001, as the feud between Otray 1 and All About Money intensified, two unnamed ABM members were chased by hooded assailants on bikes. Having hid inside the Stockwell Food and Wine shop, three members of Otray 1 opened fire, spraying the shop with bullets. Every round missed their target. But having fired indiscriminately, they wounded the shop assistant, Roshan Kelvakumar, and as she played in the aisle of her father's shop, 5-year-old Thusha Kamalesawaran was hit in the chest and was left paralysed for life. Her teenage attackers were sentenced to a minimum of 14 to 17 years each. As part of the investigation, although the police sought a motive for the attack, they knew they would never find one. As with the Lambeth-based Otray 1 dressed in red, marking their affiliation to the Bloods from LA, and the Stockwell-based ABM crew dressed in blue, aligning with the Bloods' arch-rivals, the Crips. The motive could be as meaningless as their postcode or the colour of their clothes. Styled as The Life, although gang members have more love for each other than for their own mothers, for many young boys striving to be men, being in a gang is no life. It's just a lie. No one gets rich, no one gets out, no one gets old, and being seen as angels at home and devils on the streets, you rarely see an old gang member, because they've either grown up, wised up, been locked up, or are dead. Sadly, once you're part of a gangland feud, even if you've left, the threat stays with you for life. Jermaine Joseph was an ex-gang member of Otray 1. Age 23, he'd seen it all. Blood, death and destruction. And every time the circle was the same. A young life lost, a family in grief, and another casket buried. Raised in Mitcham, Jermaine knew Sedu by the street name Nuts and knew he had a reputation to match. And with bad blood between the two rivals stemming back years, having informed the council that he was being targeted by Sedu's ABM crew, in April 2011, Jermaine was rehoused from Mitcham in southwest London to Tottenham in northeast London. On the 9th of November 2011, just weeks before Sedu's death, Jermaine received an anonymous call in which he was warned,
"We know where you live, and we're coming for you."
Unsure who would be sent, when or how, to ward off any attackers, Jermaine packed a 6-inch lock knife, small enough to hide in his pocket, and big enough to look threatening, with the hope that he would never need to use it. Monday the 26th of December 2011 was a classic British Boxing Day. Having accidentally avoided the Queen's speech, being sick of the sight of turkey, and about ready to strangle their relatives having been cooped up together for two whole days, thousands of people descended on the West End for the first day of the January sales, and with not a single snowflake to be seen, the day was warm and intensely bright. By the morning, Oxford Street was busy and bustling, as although the recent recession loomed large, lured to the city by buy one, get one free offers, 30, 50 and even 75% off, and supposedly unbeatable discounts, all writ large in red lettering across every storefront, great swathes of feverish shoppers mingled and jostled on the tight, sweaty paths, burdened by bags, bargains and screaming babies. Feeling flush as his pocket bulged with Christmas cash, 23-year-old Jermaine Joseph and his friend, 20-year-old Thulani Kumalo, hopped on the Victoria Line train at Tottenham Hale and headed several stops south to Oxford Circus. The tube was hot, the streets were rammed, and the shops were in chaos. But being super psyched to secure himself a stylish pair of trainers, Jermaine headed to Foot Locker. The same idea had by Seydou and his crew. Being just two shops up from Bond Street Tube, 1 minute from Selfridges, and opposite the Disney store, Foot Locker at 363 Oxford Street looks as it does anywhere else. Being three stories high, 50 feet wide, with tall windows on either side and no door, just a wide open entrance, with every inch of wall space covered by a kaleidoscope of brightly coloured trainers, even if you miss the big bold sign which reads Foot Locker in thick black font. With the interior stylish, the models young, and the stereo blasting hip-hop and R&B, there's no denying what they sell or who they're trying to lure in. At 1:30 p.m, as Jermaine and Thulani stood outside Foot Locker, Jermaine froze, as before him, he saw a familiar and unwelcome face from his past. Clutching a boxed bag of trainers, several steps ahead, Jermaine spotted Seydou. He said,
"Nuts looked at me and stopped walking."
Surrounded by his crew, Felix Anker, nicknamed Stagger, Louis Souza Santos, and Brian Clips Mudsy Wapatsy, who just 2 months later would be jailed for 11 years for firing a gun at two unarmed police officers.
"He congregated towards his friends and walked towards me."
Remembering the anonymous call and the death threats which had led him to flee his hometown, Jermaine said,
"My first intention was to get to safety. I ran into Foot Locker. I thought if I run into the shop, the CCTV and the security guards would stop them trying to stab me."
With the store being packed full of oblivious shoppers, some men, some teens, some kids and babies, Nuts and his crew didn't care. As unwilling to talk, their sole focus was the feud. Dashing in, Jermaine said,
"As I got near the tables, I felt like I ran into a wall of people. I turned around and I heard Seydou say to me, 'Where you going?' He was running towards me with a knife in his right hand."
Torn between killing and being killed, from his pocket, Jermaine pulled a 6-inch silver lock knife.
"I held it in front of me. I thought if I hold it out, it will deter him from attacking me."
But being battle-scarred, this wasn't the first blade Seydou had seen, and this wasn't his first knife fight, so he wasn't afraid. With both boys armed,
Nuts looked at the blade, but carried on charging towards me. He swung his right hand with the knife in it. I blocked it with my left hand.
And as screams erupted across the store, as the terrified shoppers tried to escape the swinging blades, the panicked people fled. Amidst the chaos and the confusion, unaware that he had stabbed Seydou in the left hip, Jermaine said,
"I stumbled back, and the crowd started to separate. As I was falling, I swung at Seydou with my knife. I thought I stabbed him in the back." "As I swung my knife, I heard it break. I wasn't even sure I even stabbed him. I thought I caught it on his coat, and then it broke. I remember hitting the ground, and I thought I was going to get stabbed. I curled up into a ball. I remember feeling punches and kicks."
Until suddenly, it stopped. As the crew parted, Jermaine got to his feet, stepped backwards towards the escalator and up to the safety of the second floor, as Seydou stumbled out onto the busy bustling pavement, swiftly followed by Stagger, Souza and Clips. Seizing an opportunity, the staff brought down the steel shutter of the store, shielding the customers and separating both groups. As outside, Stagger shouted,
"You stabbed him! You stabbed him!" You're dead. I know where you live.
Seconds later, Seydou collapsed. Witnessing the aftermath, a detachment of Scotland Yard's Diplomatic Protection Group stopped to give support to the paramedics, who battled to save Seydou's life, as an agitated crowd of more than 100 people jostled and pushed to get nearer. Some crying, some joking, some angry, many filming it for their own amusement, all blocking the road, making it impossible for the ambulance to get through. As a handful of police desperately tried to protect the paramedics and their patient. Having been stabbed once in the chest, the 6-inch blade penetrated 4 inches deep, right through his heart. And as the silver blade broke, it remained within, as blood pooled across the grey pavement. And as his face became paler, his bright eyes sunk, and his big beaming smile had gone, suddenly his hand dropped. And at 1:45 p.m, just one day after Christmas, 18-year-old Seydou Dirisuba was pronounced dead. Two knives were recovered from the scene, two sets of fingerprints, and CCTV footage from the shop. And although the police appealed to those who had witnessed and filmed the killing, the investigation was hampered by a refusal to assist the police and a petty code of silence. Many tributes were paid on social media, some addressed to Seydou, some by his street name of Nuts. Some made reference to his sweet smile and big personality. Some called him a soldier and a martyr. And in an emotional plea for witnesses, his grieving family stated, "Whoever took his life took our backbone away. Life seems meaningless without our special son and brother." On the 15th of November 2012, after a 4-week trial at the Old Bailey, as the jury saw that Jermaine Joseph acted in self-defense, he was cleared of both murder and manslaughter, and the case was closed. Seydou was a promising young man from a good family who had given him everything to ensure that he had a great start in life. But believing that he was a gangster who had to carry a knife, he threw it all away. And instead of becoming someone great, he became just another statistic. That year, Seydou Dirisuba became the 15th young person to be murdered on the streets of London. Another wasted life, and all for nothing. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to Murder Mile. If you're a Murky Miler, stay tuned for more rip-roaring excitement as I make a cup of tea. Ooh! But before that, here's my recommended podcasts of the week, which are Southern Gone and Murderous Miners.
People disappear every single day. Did you know that at any given time, there's an average of 90,000 missing people in the United States? Here at Southern Gone, we believe someone, somewhere, knows something. Hey everyone, I'm Christy Bryant, the host and founder of the podcast called Southern Gone. I'm a Georgia native, armchair detective, and I believe the missing deserve to be found. Join me as I investigate missing person cases right here in the southern United States. I use my tenacity, inability to hear the word no, and southern charm to shed light on past and present cases. Each episode features a different missing person case, as well as insightful interviews with the missing person's family and/or friends. Southern Gone is on a mission to spread awareness about missing people. It is my hope that if we shake the trees enough, someone will come forward to bring closure to these families. Head on over to southerngone.com to listen and subscribe on your favorite podcast app. So grab a chair, a glass of sweet tea, and get gone with Southern Gone.
Just so you know, this show is about scary stuff. So don't say I didn't warn you guys. And remember, don't be scared.
Murderous Minors brings true tales of children who have killed. Premeditated murders, accidental killings and deaths, from toddlers to 18-year-old killers, no one is too young to take a life. Join me, War Baby, as I try to tell these stories of the young who've killed, the lives they took, and even the ones who've been left behind. Why do children kill? What do we do with young killers? And do they kill again? And until next time, don't be scared.
A huge thank you goes out to my new Patreon supporters, who are Gabor Horvathand and John Poucher, who each get thank you cards of goodies from me. And a special thank you to Marianne Mattson, a very exclusive $25 patron, who not only gets a card of goodies, but also a complimentary Murder Mile mug. Ooh. This week, I have a very special secret birthday shout-out for an ardent listener of Murder Mile. Originally, she was from Leamington's Bar, via Christchurch, Sydney, and now she lives in Atlanta. Well, that narrows it down. It's her birthday on Tuesday the 16th of July. Yep, that really narrows it down. So on behalf of us all, I'd like to wish Sarah Grabrevas a very happy birthday. That special treat was arranged by Tim. If you'd like to arrange a shout-out, you can do so via the Murder Mile merch shop. And also this week, a special pod-to-pod shout-out. This week, for the Swedish podcast, Mordarpodden, which is a fabulous podcast by Dan Herning and Josephine Molin, all about murder and disappearances. Dan also makes the hugely successful serial killer podcast called Seriemordenpodden. If you understand Swedish, and because my pronunciation was unquestionably appalling there, I've put links to both shows in the show notes below. Murder Mile was researched, written and performed by myself, with the main musical themes written and performed by Eric Stein and John Books of Cult With No Name. Thank you for listening, and sleep well.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Was that good? That wasn't too bad. Good. Right. Extra mile time. Oh, lovely. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Extra Mile. Hey, how are we all? Are we all good? Are we all good? Before we do anything, I'm going to open a window because this is the hottest day of the year. It was 44 degrees in France yesterday, and it's meant to be 33 degrees today, which is why I've woken up very early to get this done. Because I didn't want the boat to get absolutely sweltering. So, wow, Jesus Christ, that's going to be hot. I'm going to open up some windows. I'm going to put some water on so I can have a couple of tea. Cup of tea time. Yeah, no, it's going to be really roasty hot today. And the problem is when you're inside a steel shell,
like, when it gets really hot, you touch the metal and all the metal is hot. It's so hot today, even my biscuits have started melting. Just gonna open up some windows. There you go, the birds have stopped tweeting. I've been fighting against birds tweeting throughout this whole record. I've had a blackbird above me talking to his mate for the last hour, really loudly, and now he's decided to shut up. There we go. Oh dear, that is going to be a roasty day, and I'm going to be inside this tin can. There we go. Window's open. Right, good. There we go. I'm just going to get rid of my old coffee. Stock up on tea. Gotta have tea. Oh. Right, there we go. Yes, powdered milk. Because we're in summer, it's back to powdered milk again. Because, oh, I'll have it within a day and it'll go all mouldy and horrible because it's out of a fridge. I do have a fridge, it's just too expensive to run. I'm out of breath now. Right, okay, where am I? Very fine north of London at the moment, which is all good, in a nice relatively quiet part, which was good, quite like it here. Nice and peaceful. Bit of a pig to get into town, which is a real problem. But apart from that, it's all good. Update for the moment. I've had tonsillitis all week, which has been great. I think I went out last week. It must have ended last week's episode. After I was recording that. No, when I was finished editing that. Went to a mate's birthday. It looks like I probably met someone there who probably had tonsillitis and passed it on to me. So that was nice. So I've had tonsillitis, so I've not slept in a good couple of days, so I sound a really bit weird. And because my throat was really swollen, I couldn't swallow as well, which makes it a nightmare, so you can't sleep, because every time you swallow, you convulse. So I haven't slept in a couple of days, and I haven't had any tea or biscuits, so this will be my first cup of tea in ages, and I haven't had any biscuits yet. But the blessing of having tonsillitis is you can have lots of ice cream, which I do like. So a nice big, I've had a couple of big tubs of Neapolitan ice cream, the really, really cheap shit. Cheaper the better, because it's got no bits in it, and it doesn't, and literally you put it in your mouth and it starts to dissolve, which is great. The only problem is living on the boat. I know it's a nice life, but when you do have medical problems, it's a real pain, because my doctor is 25 miles away, because obviously I move, but my doctor doesn't move, so it's a 50 mile round trip. When was that, Thursday? Yeah, Thursday. I decided bollocks. I was like, I need, even though I didn't tell the doctor what it was, because you're not meant to do that, I knew I needed some amoxicillin for the tonsillitis. So I got up about 5 o'clock and headed over to West London to queue up outside to do my usual thing of going in. I always love it. I sit in the doctor's surgery and I pre-rehearse what I'm going to do, because doctors don't have a lot of time. And the last thing they want is, you know, when you go in there and tell us about it. And you go, well, I was shopping on Thursday with my friend Jean. And you know Jean, who's got the bad leg. Where, do you know, it's just like, so I sat there and I went, right. She went, what's the problem? I went, right. I've had a sore throat for 6 days. It got bad in the last 2 days. I haven't been able to swallow. I haven't been able to sleep. And now it's spreading into my ears. And she's like, oh, great, okay, that does it all. You tell them everything they need to know without saying to them, I have tonsillitis. That's the secret I've learned over all these years, is never tell the doctor what you have, because they will instantly go, you almost certainly don't have that. They will try and go against it, or they will try and find out what it really is. If you give them all the symptoms as quickly as possible, and you don't tell them what you think it is, because you're not a doctor, they will come to the conclusion faster and better. It always works every time. And literally, I mean, I was in and out. I knew I needed an amoxicillin. And she looked at me and she went, yep, you're red in the throat, red in one of your ears. I'm going to put you on some amoxicillin. And I was like, oh, brilliant, thank you. Job done. It really is. So, tea's almost done. Getting there. Should I have a biscuit today? I don't know whether I should risk it. It's so hot in here already that they've probably all melted already. So, I'm just going to open up some more windows. Oh, and a door as well. I've opened that door. Oh, and that window. That window opened as well, and that window. Christ. It's only about 9 o'clock in the morning, and it's already about 26 degrees. It's picking up, I can feel it. I think after I record this, I'm going to go into town, not far town, the little village around the corner, buy some icy cold drinks, some ice cream, and then just spend the day in here editing. Oh, I can't think today, I'm so tired. And as you can hear, little planes going over because I'm heading north and there's a lot of posh people who've got little planes. Every time it's even slightly nice, these bored businessmen and women get into their little Cessnas and they start flying around and they use the canal as a guide to get them into town. Even though they don't get off, they just go into town, turn around, come back. So anyway, whew, I'm out of breath. Right. Just going to say next week, if I say next week, this is entirely irrelevant because by the time you listen to this, this will be the 11th of July or beyond and this would have happened. But so next week for me, I'm in the past. Hello, I'm in the past. Will be the meetups, the true crime meetup arranged by They Walk Among Us and Generation Y. I will be both of the London ones, but I can't make the Manchester one, unfortunately, because I can't. There's no trains to get me back to London by 11 o'clock so I can do my tour, which is really annoying. So I can't do that one. If you're there, I will see you there. I hope to see you all there. Just a quick message out there. If anyone out there is one of my patrons, when you join, I always send you a nice little email saying, hey, thanks for joining. I'm going to send you a nice little envelope, a thank you card with goodies like some stickers and all that. But I've noticed that even though I email people, a lot of people ignore the emails. And then later on, they get in touch. They go, where's my envelope? Where's my goodies? And it's like, I sent you an email, but you ignored it. So if you are one of my patrons and you do want an envelope of goodies, just message me via Patreon and give me your address and then I can send one to you. I did a message this week saying, hey people, if you want one, let me know. And loads of people went, yeah, I want one. It was like, well, send me your address. It's like, oh, I'm not psychic. Anyway, so I think I'm gonna have to work a better way of doing this because it's slightly confusing. Oh dear, I'm so tired. Right, this story, where did it come from? I remember it happening because I was working in London at the time anyway, so I remember it being on the news. I remember I was going to go into town and do some shopping, and then this happened. I've only told part of the story here because there was this killing that happened. This was outside Nighttown on Oxford Street, and then a couple of hours later there was another attack outside Nighttown. Did I just say Nighttown? I'm so tired of it. This one was outside Foot Locker on Oxford Street. The next one was outside Nighttown on Oxford Street. It happened on the same day. They're not too sure if they were connected. And then there was another one later on. So there's a lot of numpties out on the streets getting all angry and uptight. And oh, just idiots carrying knives. Really? I mean, why? Why? You carry a knife, then you're gonna have to use a knife. But the problem is, most of them are idiots. They don't know how to use a knife. They just use it as a status. Well, most of it's a status symbol, isn't it? It's like, I got a knife and me got me a shank. But they don't know how to use it. And then when they're forced into a situation where they have to use a knife, they realise that they don't know how to use it. Hence, they just wave it around like twats. Like with the story that I told you in there about the 5-year-old girl who was paralysed when the two, inverted commas, gang members fired up the shop. They didn't use targeted firing. They literally just sprayed the shop full of bullets because they're idiots, because they don't know any better. They spend all of their time on PlayStations. They don't understand the difference between real life and what they're, you know, pressing the green triangle. Ugh, anyway. Just getting that out of my system because I deliberately tried to write this story, you probably noticed, in a very fair way. Obviously, you'll hear these stories in the press all the time, and the press always take like a side to it or things like that. So, and because I'm not part of their world, you know, it's not easy for me to understand why they decided to go into a gang instead of trying to escape their situation, instead of fighting to get out of an awful situation, like, you know, if you're living in poverty or things like that. You know, a vast majority of people, as I mentioned in here, work really hard. You know, it doesn't matter whether they're rich or poor. It's like there's on one of these forums I'm on, there's someone always, every time a crime happens, someone always goes, oh, well, it's all about austerity, isn't it? It's like, no, it's not, because not all crime is about austerity. It's like if crime was about austerity, given the fact in Britain, like I think they say, well, is it 10% of the population live underneath the poverty line? That would mean that 10%, all of those people would be criminals, but they're not. The vast majority of people, whether rich, medium, poor, are good, decent people. You have the same, pretty much the same numbers of criminals in all classes, really. Do you know, it's just a different style of criminal. What they steal, do you know, the poor person goes shoplifting, the rich person does tax evasion. Do you know, there's no difference. Is it all criminals? Anyway, this is something that I often say to people. Do you know, for most people, it's easier to destroy something than it is to build it. Do you know, it takes a lot of hard work. So I always give this example that if you were to give 100 people a nice Les Paul guitar, 1956 Les Paul guitar, a nice really piece of artwork, but beautiful to play, beautiful sound. If you give 100 people that guitar, 10% of them would learn to play it. Only 1% would probably go on to become professional with it, because it's really difficult. It takes like 10,000 hours to become an expert at anything. Let's be honest, the vast majority of us, if we were given a guitar, we'd go ding, 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 we'd realise it's hard work and we'd give up. And that's just normal. So that'd be the most of us would take the guitar. We'd either use it as decoration, or realising its value, we would either give it to a friend, a really good friend, as a present, or we'd sell it to buy the things we need, such as, you know, nappies, or take the family on holiday if it's worth good money. Many of us just won't play it at all. Some people will just get it, they'll grab it and they'll just go, right, I'll just go and sell it for drugs and a big blowout. That's fine, that's what they choose to do. Some people will take the guitar and they'll destroy it. Why? Because it represents something that they hate, which is that if you work hard enough, you'll succeed. Noisy running people. And bikes as well. Glad I finished when I did. So I think that's it. I know with the press, they always say that people on council estates, you know, it's breeding ground for crime, but it's not. The vast majority of people are good, decent people. No matter where you go, no matter where it's, whether it's on a state or a posh bit or whatever, you get good, decent people, and then you get a small, tiny amount of people who are criminals, or in this case, go into gangs. Why? Because it's easier to be in a gang than it is to go and do something decent with your life. Anyway, but that's their choice. So what I've tried to do, I'm releasing a little bit of tension now. But in this story, you know, I've tried to write it as fairly as possible. I haven't tried to judge anyone on this. You know, they made the decision. But at the end, you know, it is a wasted life. What did he achieve? What was achieved by this at all? Nothing. And I know some of his friends said, you know, he was a soldier and a martyr. It's just absolute dog shit. It's like, what did he die for? Did he die for anything important? Did he become the next Rosa Parks? No. Just another statistic. And what you're left with, again, is grieving families. And I think that's what a lot of these young boys forget, is that they're off doing their thing, you know. They like to say, oh, you know, I was forced into it because of a situation. That's bollocks. They love the gangster culture, which is why they love the music that they do, which is why they choose to wear the clothes that they do. You know, it's a decision. It's more exciting to them than joining Scouts, or it's more exciting to them than doing an IT course or whatever. So as you probably noticed in this story, I've tried to be as balanced as possible, because I've had access to the original police files, during which I can kind of, you know, if anyone were to say, oh, I didn't say that, you know, I've got access to witness statements and I can just point to an exact quote and they go, there you go, now piss off. God, I'm a bit grumpy today. And because there was a lot written about this case, and a lot of it, I have to say, in the tabloid papers, were absolute dog shit, like really unfairly written, to the point where the family quite often were getting in touch with them and saying, you're going to have to retract this. Have a look at the Daily Mail articles about it. So many times is written, oh, in an earlier version of this, we said that he was a gangster, but do you know, this is unfair and it's not true. And it's just like, oh, fucking tabloid, sorry for my bad language, tabloid newspapers. That's the problem with them, is they know that they can just fire out news articles and not bother with the repercussions. They're like, they'll do it. This is what I hate. They do a front page story when they'll go like they'll say, Michael is a drug addict paedophile, and then they'll, not that they've done this, you know, this is just an example. They say they would plaster my picture over the page, and then all these horrible stuff about me, and then if it goes to court, they would have to pay me like a small, for them would be pocket change. And then you'll notice a couple of weeks later, in a small section on page 17 in the bottom, it will say, in an article we recently wrote that Michael was a drug addict paedophile. This is correct. We retract the statement. And that's it. That's all they have to do. They make a fortune out of being scandalous and, you know, trying to sell crazy stories to people who are basically just thick, let's be honest. Oh, I'm grumpy today. But when it comes to time to retract these stories, they don't use the same amount of ink that they do to besmirch someone. They hide it away elsewhere. I think the law should change. I think if you write something bad about someone, you should have to use the same amount of ink to praise them as well. If you're found guilty of this, you should have to put a front page story in that. If you say someone is like a drug addict paedophile, the next day, if that's proven wrong, you have to use the same place, same positioning, same amount of ink, same words, you know, really force the newspapers to bloody wake up and say to them, so the newspaper has to say Michael is a great person and he's raised all this money for charity. I think they should be forced to do that rather than paying a pittance amount of money that they can afford and then hiding a retraction in a place where no one's going to read. You can tell I haven't slept. I'm on a bit of a rant today. Anyway, so there was a lot of articles written which were unfair, I felt. So what I've tried to do in this story is really just try and be as fair as possible. Do you know, there are things that can't be proven, like even with the court case just before Seydou's murder. So it was kind of, even though he was in court on charges for stealing a BlackBerry, that was like a week before he died, because the case wasn't concluded because he died. I can't really say that he was in court for that. I can't find any transcript for that case because it was just an initial hearing. So, and because it was never concluded, it can't be proven whether he did it or not. So therefore, because of that, I've had to write supposed and alleged. And there's a lot of that in there. And I've used, you know, there's unknown sources in there. So I've tried to be as honest as possible about what's where and who's... Oh, this was a complicated one to write. This really took a lot longer than expected. But what I really wanted to do was to focus on a story about a young man who was really just given all the chances, I felt. Do you know, you think about it, he's got a good family, still together, good brother and sister, do you know, even though they're not in one of the best parts of town, do you know, they raised him as good and moral, he had a good religious background, good education, do you know, he was going places, he was going to college, do you know, people liked him, he was bright. When you look at it, he had all the chances, and he threw it away. If anything, I would say he threw it in his parents' face. You know, they gave up a lot. They moved from the Ivory Coast to come to Ivory Coast. I'm sure it's not that great, but I'm sure it's idyllic in comparison to, you know, parts of London, part of, you know, smoggy, grey, old, dirty London. But they gave up a lot because they wanted a better life for their children. Do you know? So, I wanted to write. I wish I knew more about the parents. I would love to have written more about how the parents felt, but they didn't give many statements, so I couldn't really write that much about them. But and there's also the balance in there of, you know, even though it was said in court that he was in a gang, some of the stuff was based on the testimony of the prosecution and Jermaine Joseph, who said that Nuts, who is Seydou's street name, was a gang leader and, you know, things like that. And because that can't be proven, again, I've used that in there, but again, I've had to say, you know, that's his opinion. But, you know, that gangs don't really have, they don't have ID cards. Do you know, they don't have a rotor. People don't clock in. So you can't really prove a lot of things. And also, do you know, I could just get some mates together today and say, we as a gang in it. And it's like, are we a gang, really? It's like, that's why it's so difficult for the police, even though they say there's 250-ish active gangs in London. It changes all the time. Like, even they say, do you know, there's cliques within the gangs. So sometimes, even though a gang may only have 15 people, that might be three cliques within a gang of 15. So, do you know, and it changes and it moves all the time. But it's true, you never see an old gang member. You never see an old boy who's still in a gang. It's like, they get to kind of early to mid-20s and that's it. It's done. Either they're in prison or they're dead or they've grown up. And that's what a lot of ex-gang members do. It's like, you know, they talk about when they're younger, it's the life. It's because they're bored. There's nothing better to do. But when they start growing up and they have responsibilities, they realise it's playtime is over. It's time to wake up now. It's like you can't go around pretending that you is a gangster, innit? It's like, you're married, you got kids, you got a job, you got responsibility. Do you know, you can't spend your life going in and out of prison. You're just an idiot if you are, really. rant over, I think. I don't know. So I'm just gonna check the time because I don't want to overrun. Right. I thought I'd do some stats for you. I was gonna throw this into the episode, but I didn't do it. So 2011, there were 118 murders that year in London, which. which is roughly one every 3 days. But then again, London does have a population of 9 million people. In total, across England and Wales, don't ask me why the stats are always England and Wales. It really annoys me, this does. Really throws everything off. There's on average, 720 murders in England and Wales. Why they don't do it as the UK, I don't know. But the population of the UK is 64 million. What is the population of England and Wales? I don't know. I think it's 56 million, but I'm not too sure. Anyway, statistically, it's a very safe country. I think if you go back to one of the Minimal episodes, I did the Police Constable Arsenal Guinness's rundown of crime stats. And it is a really safe place. It's, as they say, you know, I've got it written here. This is 60% of all crime is committed by gangs. 40% of those who are murdered are usually associated with drugs or the sex trade. So, you know, given the fact that in England and Wales we have on average 700 murders a year, if 40% of those is to do with sex trade and drugs, so what's that? That's 300. So that's not bad, really, considering our population. I guess if you look at the... No, I'm not going to say that. I was going to go into a little rant about gun culture there, but do you know what? I'm not going to bother because I know the fallout it's going to cause. If you like guns, fine. But as with most gangs, do you know what? It's always difficult for the police to get data because gangs don't deal with the police. Whether they're the perpetrator or the victim, it really is a code of silence. But as mentioned in here, if you're a gang, it's hard to get out. It really is. It was hard to get some really good. Oh, I'm gonna have a cup of tea. Not a cup of tea, a swig of tea. I can't have a whole cup of tea. I could. Tell me I could. I was trying to find some... With this kind of article, the press kind of jumped all over it, and there's a lot of the same information. None of them turned up at the scene, which I've mentioned before. Journalists rarely ever do. They just get the press report, and then they fabricate a lot of information around it, most of which is based on things that they find on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook and blah, 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 blah. And it's hard to get really good, solid pieces of information. But what I did was I had a really good trawl around various blogs because there was a bit of an emotional outpouring from his friends. There were a lot of people who kind of knew Seydou. So I found some blogs by them. So if you go onto my website, I'll post all of the links that I've used on there. So you can have a trawl through them if you like. But there were some that were really nice. This was from Tragicorus 888. I'll just read this. So a young London rapper has been criticised by anti-knife crime campaigners for making gang signs from his hospital bed whilst being treated for stab wounds. However, this photo is not of him, but of another former gang member, Sedu Dirasuba. Here he is apparently making the same gang signs. As well as being a former gang member, Sedu Dirasuba was an able young man. How do I know this? I had a conversation with a black teacher who helped educate him. This Nigerian lady, I've kind of half mentioned her in the story, a former world national and international tennis player, an excellent mother whose daughter was at the time living and studying in Catalan Spain, had this to say about Mr. Dirasuba. He was a charming, personable young man with a lot of potential and a hard-working, conscientious mother. Our only real concern was his poor attendance. He could easily have excelled academically. I'm shocked to hear about his death. It couldn't possibly be a mistake, could it? ? The bits that I missed out of the story, as I mentioned, you know, when he was dying, there was a lot of people. There were a lot of surge of people who were quite angry. He kind of felt sorry for the police there. There was only a handful of police trying to hold back like 100 people, many of whom wanted to come in and get some pictures, many of whom decided that they wanted to be angry about it because they saw the police and it was like, let's get angry at the police. And it's like, the police are there trying to save your friend. Yeah, paramedics are trying to there save your friend. But there was people who were just angry. You know, there's angry dickheads everywhere. There really is. And they're desperate for attention, and that's what they want is attention. But unfortunately, because he was stabbed in the hip, they had to remove his trousers. So there was some idiots online who were making nasty, spurious claims about Sedu because he died and he wasn't wearing any trousers. You know, these are the kind of idiots who leave the trolls who have nothing better to do is spend their whole life online. So I'm struggling a bit today to put thoughts in my head. After this, there was a real backlash. They didn't find Jermaine Joseph immediately afterwards. And his friend, I haven't mentioned much about his friend who he was with, because the judge actually ended up throwing out that whole side of the court. You know, his friend who he was with, who he went into town with, the judge was like, well, you've clearly got nothing to do with this. Let's just entirely get rid of that side of the case. So, but afterwards they need to find out who did it, who was involved. Obviously there was a code of silence amongst gang members, blah, 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 blah. So the police had to go kicking down doors of known gang members to find out who it was. This was in the Telegraph. The teenager was knifed to death following a fight outside a sports shop of the UK's busiest street on Monday. Following the death, another man... Oh, yeah, this was the nighttime one. Following the death, another man was stabbed on the same street 4 hours later in what police fear could have been a revenge attack. Now, following fears that other attacks were planned, Scotland Yard have made a series of raids and arrests in an attempt to prevent tension between gangs in the South London area escalating. Sedu, 18, bled to death in front of shoppers after being stabbed once in the heart. It is understood that he was known... They've made a spelling mistake there. That he was known to be on the periphery of the South London gang scene. As I mentioned in here, some people said he was the gang leader. Some people said he was a senior member. They say he's on the periphery. Other people said he wasn't in the gang. So it's hard to pin down exactly where what he was. The raids in Merton, Wandsworth, Southwark and Westminster resulted in 13 arrests for offences including GBH, robbery, affray, intent to supply drugs, burglary, forgery and handling stolen goods. Commander... God, they've made another mistake there. That's very odd for the Telegraph. The commander for the investigation said, we are aware of rising tensions in the wake of the murder and are monitoring the situation closely, including various comments that have been made on social media network sites. We felt it vital to take robust and prompt action in order to preempt any potential future violence. So that was that. What I'm going to do on my blog... just to mention, each week I do a blog that goes with it. A lot of people, it's great. Some people do look at it, some people don't. But on the blog every week, I do there will be the location video is on there. There'll be a little map so you can see where it is in relation to all the other murders that have been on Murder Mile. There'll be some photos on there. There might be some crime scene photos. This is every Thursday when the episode goes out. There will be a blog on there. And what I'm going to do on there as well, I'm going to show you some. It's a bit grainy. Some mobile phone footage that was shot on the day. You can see that the paramedics trying to attend to Sedu and the police trying to hold back literally 100-150 people and everyone getting angry, and you can see that footage for yourself and think, what absolute idiots. Why don't they just let the police and the paramedics do their job to save their friend? And there's another video on there that I will show. It was a tribute video to Sedu. And I'll put that on there as well, so you can have a look at that. That was kind of interesting. That was done by friends of his, and I think I actually got more information out of that video than I did out of most of the tabloid newspapers. So that's where I've tried to go with this one. I've used kind of the piece of the court documents, the AP Wire stuff, the stuff that was in the press to give me an outline of the story. But the bulk of it I used by just going to blogs, social media, kind of tributes to Sedu, and just trying to base it out that way. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed that one. That was as I've said before, I'm always trying to do something different. You know, sometimes we'll have really, really emotional ones. There's a nice reaction from everyone for the Ben and Freya Peterson one, the Hyde Park bombing one. I quite enjoyed that one. That one came out of the blue. That was a last minute where I found the story and I was like, that needs to go in. And I thought it'd make a nice balance from all the other ones, because we'd had a couple of, you know, when you have, as I said before, you know, if you have a murdered prostitute one, then it's nice afterwards to, not nice, it's a bad thing to say, then it's nice to have kind of a robbery one, then it's nice after that to have a terrorism one. I try and balance it out, and sometimes I have a really emotional one, like the Jacqueline Birrie one. I like that one because it was more of a kind of a murder mystery. And then Joe, we had the Charlie Chergwin one, the one with the workhouse that went down quite well. That was an emotional one. This one, obviously not an emotional one, but what I really wanted to do was give a snapshot of kind of a world that we don't really know a lot about. And for us, it's kind of quite confusing as to why join a gang? Why believe that you have to carry a knife? Why is it so important that just because that guy wears blue and you wear red, that's enough to want to kill him? It's like, you know, why? So that's why I'm doing that with that. We've got an interesting one next week. What's next week's one? Yeah, next week's one, that'll be interesting. I think last week's one, what was last week's one? I don't remember. Where am I? What's going on? F65. What was F65? Oh, it was the Gordon Johnson one. See, you're listening to this, and I'm 2 weeks ahead of you, so I have no idea what I did last week, which for you is, yeah, that'd be last week as well. The Gordon Johnson one, again, that's a different one, although in the era that we're normally in, kind of 1940s-ish and in Soho, I thought that was quite interesting because it's kind of, what happened? You know, it's not an emotional one. It was a little bit funny when I was going through it, and I was thinking, oh, do you know, he's had a really rough life, because it's like, how many times can you get hit on the head? And you think it's going one way, you think he's going to turn into like a killer or something, but actually he stays the same. And then for some reason Thomas Edward Croft comes in and stabs that guy to death, and you just think, why? Weirdly, there's a lot of parallels, isn't there, between episode 65 and 66. Do you know, you have, last week we had a guy who was in, even though he was in the army, the US army, and this guy is in a gang, both have their own kind of uniform, both believe that they have to carry a knife, both killed for their friends. Weirdly, there's a lot of similarities, isn't there? I hadn't really thought about that, but is there a difference between them? Do you know, in a way, both of their parents are proud of them, but at the same time, I'm sure both of their parents are upset at the fact that their sons, do you know? did what they did. There's similarities there. Hadn't really thought about that, but now I have. Right, I'm going to edit this. So, hope you enjoyed that. God, it's sweltering already. It's 9:30 and it's sweltering. So I'm going to go and do some editing, have some cold drinks, have some more amoxicillin. Frick, it's hot. Oh dear, it's not a day to be outside today. I'm going to have some ice cream as well, and that's me done. So, hope you enjoyed that. Next week, we've got an interesting episode coming out next week. It's more of a mystery one, but it's a different kind of mystery one. And then I'm going to do the what I was going to call walkabout. But Police Constable Arsenal Guinness messaged me with a title, which I thought was quite good. I think he called it Murder Meander, which I quite like. I like the alliteration, but I'm thinking about calling it Meander Mile, just to go with the alliteration of Murder Mile. So that'll be it. So I'll do an episode where we'll do a little bit of a walk around London. It'll be, you know, me with my portable recorder, walking around places, taking you past sites so you can hear how close they are, past sites that you've seen, heard of before, but also hopefully throwing some stories that you've never heard of before. And who knows, we'll probably meet some nutters as well. Anyway. That's that. That's me done. I'm off now. Have yourself a good week. Tatty bye. Bye.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.